From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. When we think of nature, we don't usually think of Hawaiian forests trampled by feral pigs or dog food eating brown tree snakes. But in a world where no corner is isolated anymore, nature isn't as pristine as we might like to think. Intruders are all around us, often in the form of species plucked from one ecosystem and dropped into another, sometimes with disastrous results. Tonight on Point, the relentless march of invading species. But first, we begin in Washington, where the Supreme Court today wrapped up its session. The High Court ruled on displaying the Ten Commandments on public property, on internet file sharing, and more. And much of the focus on today's last day was whether or not Chief Justice William Rehnquist would step down. He did not. Not today, anyway. David Savage covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times, and he joins me now from Washington. David, welcome.
Hi, Gil.
So tomorrow is another day. The Chief Justice did not resign today, but where does that stand? Could it still happen in the not-so-distant future?
Yes, I think it's possible he could issue a statement sometime tomorrow saying that he is retiring. Boy, I don't have a good guess on this one. If you'd asked me a month ago or 2 months ago, I would have said, yes, surely he's going to retire at the end of the term. He's apparently doing the work. The justices say he does okay running the conference, but he sounds terrible in the courtroom. He read parts of the last opinion today, and he really struggles to get breath. You know, he says a word and then has to pause, and he's got a breathing tube, and he just doesn't look or sound healthy. On the other hand, he is doing the job. He's quite, you know, sharp mentally, and the justice says it's amazing how well prepared he is to present all the cases when they meet privately. And so I now think it's possible he may say, I'm good enough to continue for into many more months, and why should I quit?
Well, and perhaps he just didn't want to do what everyone expected. Let's talk about some specifics from the court today. The last day of the session, there was a pair of 5-4 rulings on two cases involving the Ten Commandments, one in Texas, the other in Kentucky. Let's start in Texas. What did the court decide there?
Well, they upheld the Texas Ten Commandments monument really because this was a case where there was a 5-4 split. I think it's better to say there's a majority for the strict separation view. There was five of them that said the government may not promote or advance religion. And they said that in the Kentucky case. But in the Texas case, Justice Breyer switched to the other side and said, while my view is that the government may not promote or advance religion by any sort of religious symbol, this monument in Texas doesn't look like that to me. There's 17 monuments on the Texas Capitol grounds. There are 21 plaques. There are various war monuments and monuments to the Boy Scouts and Texas Pioneer Women. He said you could walk across the Texas grounds and not even notice this. So therefore, when I look at all the facts, this doesn't look to me like a government promotion of religion. So for that reason, Breyer joined with the more conservative justices to uphold the monument in Texas.
So more history there than religion, but what about Kentucky?
More religion than history. That the justices basically said, the Kentucky officials said in a number of ways they wanted to make a religious statement by putting the Ten Commandments in their courthouses. They did this at the time Justice Roy Moore down in Alabama was in a big controversy involving the Ten Commandments. They spoke about honoring Jesus as the Prince of Ethics. And so the court looked at the evidence. Souter said in delivering the opinion, David Souter, that context matters. And if you look at the record in this case, the Kentucky judges and the Kentucky officials were trying to make a religious statement. And basically the prominent public display of religious symbols is unconstitutional, the 5-4 majority said.
And so what's the big picture takeaway here? If you're going to have the Ten Commandments anywhere in public, you better make sure it looks like history?
Yes, I think the big picture statement is that there's still five of them that believe in a sort of a strict separation view, and there are four others led by Antonin Scalia who basically say it's okay if the government acknowledges God or acknowledges religion because that's part of our founding. So five of them say no prominent displays of religious symbols, yes, it might be okay. As Souter said, you have Moses up in the facade of the court with 18 other ancient lawgivers, but that's not a problem because Moses is there. He's got the commandments, but it looks like a display of history and lawgiving. It doesn't look like a religious display. So if you're going to do it, don't make it a prominent religious display.
All right. Another ruling today on Internet file sharing, this time a unanimous decision. What did the court say on this one?
This is a big deal for the movie industry and the record industry. It basically said if a computer website is in the business of inducing people or encouraging people to freely download copyrighted works, they violate the copyright laws. Even if they're not doing the copying, if you are Grokster or Streamcast, the name of these two companies, they set up a system that allows millions of computer users to sign on to their sites and get freely download music or movies, that violates the copyright laws. And so this is a big deal for the entertainment industry because they were fearing that all their copyrighted works could go out freely on the Internet, and they had to get a copyright ruling that says computer companies can't do this. And this ruling goes a long way to what the entertainment industry was seeking.
David, thanks so much for the update.
Glad to do it, Gail.
David Savage covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with me from Washington. As we trek to work and back, often in a concrete jungle, nature can seem a far-off realm, pristine, unique, even enigmatic. It's tropical rainforests full of exotic birds and beasts, dazzling coral reefs home to schools of fish, an environment unaltered from its natural, its original state. But as our guest tonight, Alan Burdick of Discover Magazine, reveals, there may not be any place left that hasn't been invaded by some outsider, be it a human, a six-foot snake, or microscopic bacteria. Tonight on Point, invading species and what they're doing to our natural world. We invite you to join the conversation. What has invaded your backyard? Has kudzu taken over your house? What should we do? What can we do? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me this hour is Alan Burdick, senior editor for Discover Magazine and author of the book Out of Eden, An Odyssey of Ecological Invasion. He spent 9 years traveling around the world to document the impact of invasive species. Alan, thank you for traveling to be with us this hour.
Thank you, Gail. It's my pleasure.
I have to ask, what led you on this expedition, and why did it take you 9 years?
Many people would like to know the answer to that question. Well, it started quite a long time ago with an article I wrote for the New York Times Magazine about the brown tree snake in Hawaii. And very quickly, the snake is originally from Australia, and it's made its way to Guam and has eaten all the birds and caused quite a lot of ecological damage and has also begun to spread to other islands, in part by crawling into the wheel wells of airplanes and falling out at airports. And I was sort of interested in this phenomenon, in part because I was attracted to the idea that, for one thing, what's threatening biological diversity in this case isn't, strictly speaking, bulldozers and pesticides. It's other parts of nature. So what does then that tell me about what I think nature is and what my relationship to nature is? And I began, I was interested, too, in the simple notion that it was, you know, my ability to fly to places like Guam and Hawaii and see the brown tree snake that makes the snake itself capable of moving around. So, you know, if this was a crime story, I was complicit in it.
Well, clearly anything that is willing to crawl into the wheel walls of an airplane to go somewhere is very determined to get there. I can only describe this as a lovely moment, the way you describe it, when you actually held one of these things, the brown tree snake. It's, what, 6 feet long? You held it, you looked at it, you looked into its eyes. Tell us about that.
One of the odd things about the situation in Guam is it used to be, before the snake arrived, that Guam had no snakes at all on the island, and now they have more snakes per square mile than anywhere else in the world. And yet, These snakes, being nocturnal and being snakes, are very difficult to find. And I spent quite a long time with experts, you know, running around at night, looking around in the forest, trying to find a snake. And I, at a certain point, you know, you just want to find a snake for the snake of, sake of finding one. And they led me to a cage of them and gave one to me to hold. And I held it in my... held its head in my hand the way they instructed me to do, and it began to sort of wreathe itself around me. And I don't quite know how to describe the experience, except that it did make me think that, you know, much as we typically talk about the bad things that alien species do, it was important to me in that moment and subsequent moments to at least look at these things at on their own terms, and to try to understand what their movement around the world tells me about what I expect nature to do for me.
Well, it must have been some moment with that thing wrapped around you and squeezing you gently. We're going to hear some more of your stories when we come back in just a moment after a brief break here. We're talking this hour about invading species, like the brown tree snake, and how they alter their new habitats. We invite you to join the conversation. Does it matter that European green crabs wreaked havoc on shellfish populations in North America? Isn't nature always evolving? Or should we fight to preserve our ecosystems exactly as they were? You can find us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking tonight about non-native species that invade by land and sea and sometimes by airplane, and biologists' attempts to understand how they change the world's ecosystems. You can join the conversation. Are we moving toward a homogenized ecosystem where the forests in Europe and Australia and Hawaii all look exactly the same? Is this a problem, or does the natural world just adapt? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with Alan Burdick, senior editor for Discover Magazine and author of Out of Eden, An Odyssey of Ecological Invasion. And I want to ask you just a little bit more, Alan, about this brown tree snake, which will eat pretty much anything, sounds like, and also has now been seen in Hawaii. So does that mean that Hawaii's bird population is also in danger?
It potentially may be. I mean, one of the challenging aspects of the brown tree snake problem on Guam is that it wasn't until 30 years into having the snake on the island that Guam's biologists realized that, number one, the birds were disappearing, and number two, the birds were disappearing because of the snake. And so now Hawaii is in a situation where they've seen 8 or 9 snakes in the lowlands in Hawaii in the last 15 to 20 years, but they don't know. Were these isolated incidents? Were these, you know, just sort of the tip of an incipient population? Probably just isolated incidents, but we may not know for 20 to 30 years, at which point it would be too late. And Hawaii does have probably more federally listed birds than any other state in the nation. So they certainly have reason to be concerned about the arrival of a bird-eating snake.
Can you give us some more examples here? The zebra mussels, for example, or the European green crab. How do these things get from one place to another?
Well, the zebra mussel, both the zebra mussel and the European green crab are thought to have moved around in the ballast water of ocean-going ships. And ballast water is water that a large ship takes up at the beginning of a journey and dumps at the end of a journey, mainly to keep itself stable in the water. It's sort of the liquid equivalent of sandbags for hot air balloons. And as ships move this water around in millions of gallons at a time, they're also moving around crabs, mussels, larvae of all kind, all sorts of plankton, schools of fish, just massive amounts of stuff, and then it gets dumped in the Great Lakes where the zebra mussel landed in the 1980s. It lands in San Francisco Bay where the European green crab landed in the 1990s. And they begin to, you know, make themselves at home, and to the detriment often of an ecosystem that's been in place there for quite some time.
Well, not only make themselves at home, but take over, sounds like.
Well, the zebra mussel certainly is a little monopoly unto itself. It's a pistachio-sized mollusk, which doesn't sound like much, except that it grows in such dense masses that it's been known to sink navigational buoys. It clogs reservoir intake pipes. One scientist found growing on one 5-inch-long native crab something like 10,000 zebra mussels, which certainly, if you're a native clam, makes it a little difficult to open up and eat. But these zebra mussels, you know, the sheer number of them, they suck plankton out of the water in massive amounts. And again, you know, it makes the water clearer on the one hand, but really alters the food and nutritional sources for organisms that are accustomed to their usual diet.
And do they do the same thing in their home habitats, or is this they move to a new place and take over?
They don't do that in their old place, and you know, that's really one of the perennial mysteries of invasion biology is, you know, what determines whether you know, a plant or an animal that you pick up from one place that doesn't seem to be doing anything out of the ordinary in its home, why is it when you drop it in its new environment does it sometimes go completely berserk? And the questions are, I mean, it's essentially an unpredictable process.
Well, how did you change from viewing these as alien species, you know, the bad guys from somewhere else coming to fight against the good native species? You had something of a change of heart or change of mind on that?
Well, I don't know that I would say I had a change of heart, but there are sort of two essential facts about alien species, and one is that, you know, just a few of them, like the zebra mussel, can cause really widespread impacts. At the same time, a great many of them, possibly most of them, but there's a lot that scientists really don't know about the numbers, have minimal and often no impact. And I was interested in sort of looking at the gray zone largely of alien species that have kind of a, you know, insignificant impact, in part because it reveals a number of interesting things about how ecosystems are thought to work or were thought to work, and things like competition that are thought to keep invading species out but don't really act to do so. So I, you know, as a writer and sort of armchair philosopher, I'm interested in the gray zone, but it is sort of a tricky place to hang out in this political climate.
Well, is it inevitable that the invaders are going to cause some kind of harm, or is it that the ones that come in and don't cause harm pass unnoticed?
Well, both. Many of them slip in and do nothing. Many of them slip in and we don't know about them, so we don't really know what they're doing. Many of them slip in and do nothing, and only 50 years later do they turn out to, you know, play an important role in maybe the invasion of yet another species. In fact, actually on Guam, full of snakes, though the snakes have eaten all the birds, their main food source these days are introduced skinks and geckos, which, you know, at the time the skinks and geckos were introduced, probably nobody thought they would make any difference, but now they are the main prey base for this introduced snake.
Well, and you make a very interesting point in the book about how when you go to Guam and it's very quiet, there are no birds waking you up in the morning, and then you realize why the birds aren't waking you up in the morning, and that must feel a little disquieting right there.
It is disquieting, and I mean, the alien species problem is a very difficult one to articulate, you know, its urgency, in part because, you know, we don't often when we look out the window, we don't often distinguish between the forms of nature that are out there. You know, you look out and you see some birds and you think, you know, it's great. There's some birds out there. So what? Mm-hmm. And it really takes looking at it, you know, with a finer lens and thinking about where those organisms are coming from and, taking a big picture view to then begin to wonder if you know, this mass movement of organisms may not really be in our best interest in the long run.
I want to bring Edwin Groschultz into the conversation now. He's a professor of marine biology at the University of California at Davis. Hello, Edwin.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thanks, and thanks for joining us. Let me hear from you on this. What do you see as the challenge here of invaders in marine life specifically?
The challenge for managing them? I think Alan did catch that quite well. Part of this is that we don't know the systems well enough, so in addition to not being able to predict which species will come in and cause the greatest impact, in many of our coastal systems, we don't really have a good accounting of the species that are there to begin with. Certainly we know what some of the fishes are and probably the mammals and birds, but a lot of the other organisms that support the food webs in these systems, we don't know well. So there may have been extinctions. There may be some ongoing extinctions that may be tied to invasions that we haven't been able to document because we don't know the system. So I think that part of our challenge is having a better knowledge of what these systems look like as these invaders come in. But I certainly agree with Alan that one of the difficulties for managing these systems is that it is very difficult to know who the really bad actors will be. And I think the challenge there is whether we can establish protocols or management strategies that try to keep many or most of them out with the thought that, well, in doing so, we'll keep out the worst ones and we'll keep out the next catastrophic invasion.
Well, or is it even possible that this might be a self-correcting situation? Should we let nature just kind of sort it out, or should man intervene?
I think the evidence is such that we shouldn't just let nature sort it out. I think one of the things to remember is that although this is a natural process, it's just like extinction from that respect. Extinction's a natural process, just like invasion, animals extend their range. But I think by most estimates, we've increased extinction rates by something like a million-fold. So the current rate of extinction is about a million times higher than it would be naturally. And about the same is true with invasions. One of my colleagues calculated that our rate of invasion is about a million times greater than the range expansions historically. So I don't know whether our systems can really keep up with the kind of rate of change that we're forcing them to suffer through. And so I think that's I don't think that we can just sit back and expect the system to recover and rebound. I think there are enough good examples of really catastrophic extinctions, whether it's Nile perch or Hawaiian tree snails, where once we've lost the species, that we really can't recover them. So in the case of outright extinctions, I think the case is pretty clear that the system won't rebound.
But as you say, it's hard to know, you know, as you're going through with each of these. I wonder where do you draw the line in terms of what changes in the ecosystem we care about and want to do something about?
Well, I think that's right. We also don't know which ones will have greatest impacts on human economies. I think part of this is also we've been very surprised by this. Forgive me if I bring up an example that you've mentioned already, but here in California, there was a species called the Chinese mitten crab, which was introduced in about 1992 and didn't really do very much for a couple of years, so that would have been a species that no one would have paid much attention to, the sort that Alan mentioned. And suddenly in 1998 had an enormous reproductive year, and it almost brought California irrigated agriculture to a standstill, which of course is worth literally tens of billions of dollars a year, by clogging the water distribution system. So it's a strange crab that inhabits freshwater areas, and literally just about brought the pumping system down. And Alan did mention zebra mussels, which have a number of impacts on natural systems, but have very expensive impacts in the Great Lakes, and we suspect if introduced into California, could not only, because it does colonize irrigation canals and actually the whole water distribution system, and we do worry that it could bring not only irrigated agriculture to its knees, but could interrupt the water supply to Southern California, which I'm sure would get a lot of attention very rapidly if that was to happen. So part of this is not just unintended impacts on the natural world, but also in many cases unintended impact or unexpected impacts on human economies.
Certainly shows the interconnectedness of everything, doesn't it? To our phone lines now, I want to go to Nacita, Wisconsin. David is on the line. Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This is a very important topic to myself. I'm a wildlife technician and deal primarily with invasive species work at Fort McCoy, Wisconsin. And I guess what I really want to bring to the table here is the fact that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. You know, we're dealing with many terrestrial species, primarily invasive weeds in our grasslands and woodlands. And I think we need to really take a look at the horticulture industry in particular for allowing, you know, a lot of our ornamentals that are planted in suburban yards here and there and stuff can actually wreak havoc on our native ecosystems. And we deal a lot with some things that were brought in via, you know, grain and this and that and railroad ballast and such, but a lot of our woodland species, you know, our honeysuckles and stuff like that are things that really, you know, once they're planted in a suburban setting, are very easily transported, you know, vectors like birds and such that can really carry on and outward. You know, when you plant something in your own yard, you're thinking that this is something nice that you're going to have, but you don't really, no one really realizes some long-term effects of exotic species that are going to get out into our ecosystems and just take off from there.
David, so quickly, can you tell us what your biggest challenge is in the Wisconsin parks?
Well, the impacts on the grassland communities, in particular grassland birds, are taking a huge hit. We deal a lot with spotted knapweed, centaria species, and also leafy spurge. That's another one that we've been doing a lot of work with. It's just you know, something like they were saying before, you know, things once they're out of their native ecosystems, there's no checks and balances with predators and such, and things really can get out of hand. It's a huge industry that we're dealing with, and you know, we're spending lots of money on stuff that could have been prevented, you know, if we were just on the ball and thinking about what we import and different species that we import. You know, if we would have thought of that beforehand, we would have had a better chance to keep things at bay, so to speak.
Okay, David, thanks so much for the call. And Alan, let me ask you. I was combining your entire name there into Alec instead of Alan Burdick, sorry. What about David's point? I mean, he's saying that we should have been more on the ball, but it sounds as if what you found was more, you know, the invasions that we weren't expecting and would have been caught by surprise. It wasn't necessarily a matter of not being on the ball.
Well, that's the tricky thing when you get into talking about alien species, is that there are, one category of alien species are the ones that I and Ted have been discussing, like the zebra mussel or the brown tree snake, that essentially travel with us, you know, with us without our necessarily knowing that they're coming with us. Then there are the alien species that, you know, that we ostensibly love. You know, kudzu we introduced in the 1950s to control erosion, and it was just fine until it really was not under our control anymore, and now it's a major problem and an expensive problem. Feral cats are a major threat to native bird populations, but those we don't typically think of as alien species. And, I mean, I don't want to muddy the waters to the point of you know, leading people to think, who cares, you know, we shouldn't bother doing anything, but more to realize David's point that, you know, some aliens are, you know, we invite because we like the fact that they're exotic, and there's something about our very strange relationship to the notion of having exotic stuff around us that gets us into this fix in part to begin with.
Edwin Groschultz, you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Alan largely. I think we it would help to make a distinction between what we've brought in already and what we stand to bring in the future. I think that in the first part, that's where things get muddy and difficult. I mean, if you look at all of our crops are introduced, many of our fisheries, I mean, there was certainly a time in not too recent human history where nature was really out of our control and we were really struggling to, you know, to make ends meet, literally, in sort of the survival sense, and we weren't as concerned with that. And I think that there are many species that arguably cause problems, they have become part of the background. I think the issue is now, as we have an increasingly greater impact on the planet, that we now need to say, okay, well, what's not that we shouldn't manage what's in here, but I think it's more important to not confuse the need or not need to manage those with trying to keep others from coming in, because we do realize that there's a substantial cost in some cases to letting more in. So I think
all right.
That although
let me ask you to hold that thought, Edwin Groschultz, Alan Burdick, stay with us. We have to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more. Join us at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about protecting native ecosystems from some non-native invaders. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Alan Burdick, senior editor for Discover Magazine and author of Out of Eden, An Odyssey of Ecological Invasion, and with Edwin Groschultz, professor of marine biology at the University of California in Davis. I'm interested in hearing from both of you on whether is this all part of the evolutionary process, and essentially we shouldn't mess with it for fear that we will make it even worse than it is now? Alan, you first.
Well, I mean, I suppose in one sense, yes, but, you know, the evolutionary process inevitably ends in extinction for pretty much every species that's been a part of it so far. So I'm not really sure that that's the rule of law that we want to follow. I think when it comes to alien species, it really kind of forces us to ask pretty fine-tuned questions about, you know, not just do we want to have nature around us, but what kind of nature do we want to have around us? And I think there's a great deal of value in thinking, you know, at a fine-tuned level about that question and about, you know, preserving biological diversity for, you know, if no other reason, then for keeping our lives interesting and for, you know, giving our progeny and our grandkids something like our world to look at.
Well, but are we seeing new species emerging as some of the old ones are disappearing, or are you saying this is it? I mean, we're not seeing anything new showing up.
Well, you know, certainly biologists from time to time come across some odd things. I mean, I once spoke to some biologists who study mosquitoes in the London Underground, and the underground construction began at the beginning of the 20th century. And in that time, you know, some insects, some above-ground mosquitoes made their way underground and have been pushed on the cushions of air that subways push around to some far corners of the subway system and have been left alone long enough that there now are distinct subspecies of mosquito distinct to separate subway lines in London. So, you know, yes, evolution is certainly happening in strange places, but I would not really take that to be the rule of, you know, by and large, what's going on. The rate of extinction is certainly a lot higher than the rate of, you know, strange little mosquitoes growing in London underground.
Edwin, you agree?
I certainly agree. I mean, I think when you ask, is the world going to preserve as we know it, sort of, is this just a normal evolutionary process? I think these invasions and many other human influence processes are rapidly speeding up evolutionary processes, and we're not, in many cases, seeing a response. So extinctions are rapidly increasing, as I mentioned, but we're not seeing the creation of new species keeping up with that. So although we've increased extinction by about a million-fold, we've certainly done nothing to really increase the rate of speciation. So ultimately, we are trading loss of species for really a lack of new species. We're shuffling them around the planet, so any one location may see the presence of a new species, but it's not new to the planet. It's not new to the world.
I mean, the key, if I can interrupt, sure, one of the key aspects to evolution over the long term is isolation. You know, you need to have a steady flow of genetic material to an island or, you know, a subway underground tube. And then it needs to be essentially cut off and left to do its own thing for quite a long time. And the more we move around, the fewer places there are that are isolated. So we just aren't really creating pockets of isolation in which evolution can occur, by and large.
I want to take a quick phone call from Brockton, Massachusetts. Bill's on the line. Hello, Bill, and welcome.
Yes, hello. I wanted to relate my experiences on Guam. Myself, having there visited there twice, stationed there in my naval career, the first time in 1975, before the snake issue got out of hand. It was your typical tropical, lush, green, jungle-laden island, beautiful island with beautiful beaches, and the birds were there. You heard them every morning. I went back there in 1990, and already the snakes had become almost critical, and the silence was deafening. Your guest was there recently, I assume, and he says it was even quieter now. I had a point of reference of 15 years, and I saw the damage that was done then. But one point I'd like to make, though, is not just the music of the birds that you're missing, but also the critical element in the ecology. These birds will no longer be distributing seed and eating insects. This is going to have a far greater impact on the island's ecology than just the noise of their music, of their singing. And I wonder if your guests understand that impact. Now you're saying the snakes are also eating geckos, and geckos are another element that devours every night insects, far more than its weight in insects. And I'm wondering if your guests are understanding the impact that this is going to have long term.
Thank you, Bill. Let me put that to Alan. Alan, I would imagine you understand it very well.
Well, as best I can, I mean, in addition to walking through the forest in Guam and not hearing any noise, you see, you know, just everywhere spider webs, in part because the insect population in the absence of birds has just exploded. And one side effect of that has been that the gecko and skink population, a large portion of which is actually introduced, has been able to thrive in a way that it never was before. But also, you know, agriculturally, having a lot of insects around is not really in everybody's best interest. So there has been an economic impact to that as well. I mean, I should say too, there's a big issue now because the military is about to spend about $10 billion expanding the air base and naval base on Guam in such a way that it would become really the nexus of air traffic out in the Pacific. So the potential for this snake to spread is quite larger now and looming quite large than it ever has before.
Alan, I know you were a philosophy major in college, or so I'm told. Do you see this as more than a biological question? Is this a moral or perhaps spiritual one?
I don't know about a moral question, but spiritually, I mean, for me, the most compelling experiences in going out. I mean, I should say, you know, I sort of wrote this book in part because I really wanted to get out and find nature. I wanted to see what unhomogenized nature looks like. And I found, for one thing, that I had to go far to find it. I really had to go far to find places that were untouched by us. And I found it, oddly enough, often enough under the microscope with people like Ted Grossholtz and other marine biologists, you know, with people who study insects. And in a way, I discovered that there really is this sort of lost world of biological diversity that it takes place right under our noses. For me, it was a kind of a spiritual awakening, if we can dare call it that.
And Edwin Grossholtz, how do you see this? Do you see yourself as a professor of marine biology? Are you a custodian, a guardian of marine life?
Well, to some degree, I mean, we tend to be the keepers of the list and what we sort of assume to be the natural order of things. But I think we exist, as all of us do, in a greater culture. And I think what struck me about the last phone call and the experiences of others elsewhere, like those in Guam and those in, say, Australia that saw rabbits ravage their country, is that if you've seen the really negative impacts of invasions, then I think you have a very different view of it than we do in this country outside of a few, like perhaps Dutch elm disease or chestnut blight. Most Americans really, you know, maybe some working in the wildlands of the West, have really not been greatly affected by a significant invasion. So I think, you know, my job and my response is colored by the fact that I am part of a culture that just, you know, say, well, is this really that important? And so I think that one of my job really is to sort of spell out how important these kinds of things can be.
Edwin Groschultz, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Professor of Marine Biology at the University of California in Davis. Alan Burdick, thank you very much. Senior editor for Discover Magazine, author of Out of Eden, An Odyssey of Ecological Invasion. Thanks for sharing your story.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, a look at the newly elected president of Iran. This is On Point. President Bush and German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder had some strong words for Iran today. Addressing reporters, the two leaders emphasized the importance of a tough, unified front on Iran's nuclear program. The statements come at a tense time for all involved. President Bush has expressed skepticism about the legitimacy of Iran's recent elections. The Iranian president-elect Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is regarded as a hardliner with little regard for what the U.S. thinks. He has signaled lukewarm willingness to continue talks with Europe, but also says he will not rule out nuclear development if it is in Iran's national interest. Shireen Hunter is director of the Islam program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She writes extensively about political and economic issues in the Middle East. And Shireen Hunter joins me now from Washington, D.C. for more about the future of U.S. policy toward Iran. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, we know he's a hardliner. What else can you tell us about Iran's new president?
Well, first of all, he is obviously he has played on it. He's someone that really comes from very, very humble origins and has essentially, brought himself up by his own efforts. And he was in the Revolutionary Guards and fought in the Iran-Iraq War and. Before that was a member of the Basij militia and served in minor post as governor of the province of Ardabil. And then when the conservatives won the city council elections in Tehran some time ago, he was chosen to be the mayor of Tehran. Since being mayor, he has taken some actions that on social sphere that could be seen as sort of trying to reverse some of the openings that we had witnessed under President Khatami, but even before that. But on the other hand, he seems to have streamlined the city administration and it seems to have managed the city affairs better. So we will have to see whether he can do that at the national level or not.
Well, exactly. Prior to this election, Ahmadinejad was viewed as a very long bet. Rafsanjani was thought to be a shoo-in, or at least that's what we were reading here. How did he win, and especially how did he win in a landslide?
Well, there are several things that we have to keep in mind. One of the most important thing is that, first of all, if you really tally all the votes that were cast during the first round of elections, people who could be considered reformist, from the more what I call moderate reformists to moderate conservatives, garnered more than 55% or so of the votes. What happened in the second round actually were two things. One was that the reformist camp really was divided. And the fact of the matter is that the reformist support for Rafsanjani came very late and was very lukewarm. For example, the main reformist organization, the Front for the Unity and Participation of Iran, never by name supported Rafsanjani. And this is one element. As a result, I think this played into Ahmadinejad's favor. The other factor was that Rafsanjani has developed a reputation, and reformists in the past, 8 years, have not tired of hammering this on that he has accumulated a lot of wealth during the time that he was president, and that, you know, he really has lost touch with the people and the so-called values of the revolution. Whereas Ahmadinejad, really played the populist card, and his demeanor also was very humble. For example, the contrast was made when Rafsanjani went to cast his vote. He just walked in there and cast his vote and left, whereas the other guy went and stood in line and talked with the people and so on and so forth. So I think that also contributed to his victory. And the third thing is that he really tried to assuage the fears. And I'm not going to prejudge one way or another, because we have to see him actually in action once he assumes presidency. But he sort of made a mockery of some of accusations that if he comes, he's going to establish a Taliban-style government in Iran and so on. And he talked a lot of, moderation and against extremism of any kind. So I think that the combination of these factors led to his landslide victory during the second round.
Well, we only have about a minute left. Do you see the relationship between the U.S. and Iran getting better with him as president, or getting worse?
Well, I really don't think that the dynamics of U.S.-Iran relations have changed very much. I mean, I think that, you know, we have always said that, Ayatollah Khamenei had the final say in that, and I think that they had already settled on a particular line. And even although initially Ahmadinejad said that we really don't need United States, but later he said, well, if U.S. takes positive actions, we are willing to deal with them. Now, therefore, I think that a lot would depend on the U.S. attitude. Actually,
we have to leave it there. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Dr. Shireen Hunter is director of the Islam program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She spoke with us from Washington, D.C. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.